is Professor Yuda, who will talk about her work as DCT and functional recovery following post-traumatic injury. Professor Yuda is a director at London Centre on Aging, and he is also the vice chair of research department of rehabilitation medicine. Welcome, Professor Yuda.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. I had a wonderful time the last few days in Alta, and got to see the Northern Lights. So, just a brief time when they were dancing in the sky. So, this was one of the highlight trips of my life. What I would like to do today, because I have more gray hair than most of my colleagues that are speaking, that I want to put some of this issue of plasticity into an historical context. And when I first started learning about plasticity, I was actually a skeptic, as all of us as scientists should be skeptics. And we have two jobs as scientists. We take seemingly random events and try to put them into order, and we try to be skeptical about what we see, that it's not superstition. And so we still fight that as humans. It's easy for us to be superstitious when we see positive results. But I want to take you back a little bit into how some of these ideas unfolded, how some of my own work unfolded, and all the way up to some new technologies involving implanted microelectronic devices to help modulate pathways within the brain. And also, if I have one problem with speaking, it's that I sometimes go too long. So I have the dogs from the dog sled team in Alta that will bark at me when if I go over, because we have lunch to go to afterwards. I often show this slide. This is a very old slide from one of my colleagues, Pam Duncan, showing what we now know as natural or spontaneous recovery with minor, moderate, and major strokes. And this is a typical Pugelmeier assessment of motor recovery in human stroke patients. And while you can divide these groups and you can understand their ultimate endpoint based on some of the initial assessment scores, they all improve to some degree. And those with minor strokes, some of them will spontaneously recover even to normal into the normal range. Those with severe or major strokes, while there is some improvement, they will stay very severely impaired for a lifetime. And so we know that they improve, and we try to understand a bit about the why natural recovery occurs. We know some of that is due to initial so-called neural shock or diastasis in the brain. We'll talk about that a little bit. But also, we can compensate, as Dr. Klein has described, in order to attain better function. Now, a lot of our analysis of what we know about recovery and the neural basis for recovery is based on, in general, maps of the motor system. And on the left here, you see the map of the motor homunculus that's still in all the textbooks, and it's been there for decades, unchanged. And on the right, a typical fMRI image of bolt signals as one moves their finger and the opposite side of the motor and somatosensory cortex light up very specifically. And as we see changes in these maps, we have used this as a biomarker of recovery. And one of the main points I want to address today is that while these biomarkers are associated with changes in the brain, and they certainly are evidence that plasticity is occurring, their relationship to recovery is not so straightforward, and we really are still struggling to understand what these biomarkers really mean, and I'll try to give you a sense of that. Now, these maps have been known for a long time. In fact, I'm really old. I will go back to the 1860s, and the theoretical basis for this was formed by Hewlings Jackson and Paul Broca in the 1860s. But then later in the 1870s, very rapid changes took place with some what we would call primitive techniques to stimulate the brain in the 1870s. In this case, Fritsch and Hitzig in a cat for the first time showed localization of motor functions by stimulating the surface of the brain in cats and seeing different movements. Now, they're too small to see the actual data points, but if any of you are actually doing dissertations right now, you will be jealous because Fritsch and Hitzig wrote one of the most famous papers in the history of neuroscience on localization of function with four data points. Look at that paper and you will see four different symbols with four different movements evoked in a cat. So this is something that then was later replicated by David Ferrier in monkey. For some reason, a carnivore brain was pictured in the paper, and I suspect it's because as now, there was a great rise in animal rights activism in England, and I think he was a little concerned that if he showed a primate brain in the paper, that he would be the target of the animal rights activists, and in fact, he was. But these studies in the late 1800s really set the stage for what we do now in motor mapping. And in the importance for humans wasn't fully realized until much later when this gentleman, Wilder Penfield, and you rarely see, he's a Canadian neurosurgeon, but you rarely see him as a young man in his laboratory. These are from a review paper by Mark Schieber, if you want to know more of the history of this. But Penfield exposed the cortical surface in patients that were either undergoing resections for tumors or an epileptic focus, and he would map the surface of the brain by stimulating in locally anesthetized patients who are awake, stimulating the brain, evoking movements, and creating this homunculus both of the somatosensory motor strip and the somatosensory strip in these patients. And this is really the basis. These studies during the late 30s and early 40s were the basis for what we know about localization of function in the motor cortex. And even Penfield was aware that, that things weren't completely static, but the idea that the brain was plastic, and just by the way, we have some more sophisticated electrodes now. For example, much of the mapping, either for sensory function or for motor outputs, is done with various types of grids that are put either epidurally or subdurally. And so we have the fancier electrodes. The techniques are not unchanged dramatically if you're doing surface stimulation to define motor outputs, to determine so-called aliquot areas of the cortex to avoid removing an important part of the motor cortex, for example, involved in motor speech. Now, in animal models, we use a technique that was developed by Hiroshi Asanuma and his colleagues back in the 70s, in which Jeff Kime showed some pictures of this in a rat, in which we drive a microelectrode down into layer 5 of the motor cortex, and these little colored patches represent different movements that are evoked. This happens to be in a squirrel monkey, and just like in the rat, we can, and in the human, we can derive maps of motor outputs. This microstimulation technique is actually because we're driving down into the vicinity of the corticospinal neurons that project down to spinal cord motor neurons has a level of spatial precision that's much greater than surface stimulation. And these microelectrodes are very small, and instead of the milliamp currents that are used with surface stimulation, we use up to about 100 microamps. Even in an anesthetized monkey, though, we often can evoke movements with a train of pulses of only 1 microamp, very small amounts of electrical current. And the reason for this is that, and this is a slice through a parasagittal slice through the motor cortex of a squirrel monkey. This is the central sulcus. This is the somatosensory cortex. If you actually, it's really helpful if you squint a little bit, you can see differences in the histology. And in fact, a lot of histologists to this day would look at this Nissl stain and squint and say, okay, I see big cells here. I can draw a line here. So you literally could take a 5-year-old and teach them how to do histology and divide up these areas, whether you have primary motor cortex or area 4 with the large pyramidal neurons that represent most of the corticospinal neurons, the somatosensory cortex, which has few of these large pyramidal neurons in layer 5, but a very granular layer 4, and a central sulcus between. So if you drive one of these microelectrodes into the cortex, with just 1 to 10 microamps of current, the area that you're stimulating is relatively small and probably fewer than 1,000 corticospinal neurons is actually stimulated directly by the current. This study by Cam Teske and his colleagues showed that recently that you could that most of the activation of these corticospinal neurons is via the dendrites, that's the axon, the synapse on the dendrites of the pyramidal neurons, the corticospinal neurons. Some of these are actually inhibitory and they're stimulated at the same time. So most of the effects of stimulating with a microelectrode in the motor cortex are due to these synaptic events onto the corticospinal outputs. Now, I give you this level of detail because I'm setting the stage for some of the neural substrate for why brains or these maps are plastic. So we know that, and I found this out long ago. My very first postdoctoral experience was with a gentleman named Michael Merznick, who was one of the pioneers in plasticity, showed many plasticity phenomena in auditory cortex and somatosensory cortex. And I went to his lab to try to move what I told him I wanted to do this plasticity work in an area of the brain that's clinically important, not just somatosensory cortex. Well, he kind of giggled a bit, and Mike has a sarcastic wit, and so he held back in slamming me as a young postdoc, and he waited for the right time. And this was it. I came to him with this data. And I said, Mike, I've been learning how to do this so-called intracortical microstimulation. And I've been doing this in rats, and I make this rat map of the forelimb in red here. And then I introduce an electrode, and I just repeatedly stimulate with that electrode for an hour. And lo and behold, I remap the brain, and the forelimb map is much larger. I think, I believe now the plasticity, and I hate to use that word belief after our wonderful introduction talk, but I was a non-believer. I came to Mike's lab as a skeptic that plasticity was an epiphenomenon. It was all artifact. And I saw this effect and I said, this is wonderful. I can manipulate the motor cortex map and perhaps we can use some kind of stimulation technique to alter function. And so this is Mike. If any of you have met him, again, he has a very sarcastic wit. And he said, well, that's a very wonderful result. Now, I have to ask you, have you even heard of Charles Sherrington? And I, of course, had heard of Charles Sherrington. He's the father of modern neurophysiology. And Mike said, go back and read some of his papers. And so I dug through his papers and reading about his ancient techniques of stimulating and timing some of the events back in the day. It was very difficult to time neurophysiological events back in 1912 with the techniques that were available. So sometimes they would use a wire that was actually a conductor, and when the wire was broken, the voltage would be applied to the cortex. And in order to precisely time it, they would use a rifle to shoot the wire, and so they had very precise timings of these events. But I came across this paper on the instability of a cortical point, and I started reading, and I was shocked that in 1912, Sherrington had already discovered this. This was my first big discovery as a postdoc in 1912. And so to make things worse, I had to sheepishly go back into Mike's office and I said, well, I found this quote. We find the successive stimulation of one and the same cortical point at short intervals of time usually produce, as is well known, 1912, it's well known, marked facilitation and intensification of the response. And I didn't know what to say. And then he said, well, you know, this is, you've rediscovered this, you could put this into a historical context, you're using modern techniques. I said, but Mike, he did it better than me. He actually had electromyographic results, and it was a fabulous study with Graham Brown and Sherrington discovering that repeated stimulation could alter these motor maps. So what do motor maps mean if you can simply stimulate them repeatedly and change them within an hour? And of course, they went back to normal. And there have been a number of studies showing that this is due to cortical linkages and changing the excitatory and inhibitory activity onto these neurons. But nonetheless, it really embarked me on understanding more about motor maps and what they may mean. And we subsequently showed that if you train monkeys on a task, and it's really very much the same task that that Dr. Keim showed with the pellet retrieval of the rats. The monkeys are a bit better, and you can get them to do a little more difficult tasks by picking pellets out of deep, narrow wells. And as they get better at this task, the red areas, which are the representation of the fingers, expand. Yellow areas, which are actually combinations of movements, expand. And in fact, each animal is a bit idiosyncratic. And if an animal uses a finger flexion, wrist extension motion, those are the movements that are evoked in this very artificially generated map using electrical stimulation in an anesthetized animal. As the animal forgets how to do the task, those areas, especially those yellow conjoint movements, go away, and they reappear as you reacquire the task. Likewise, otherwise healthy animals that are restricted in their use have the opposite changes. These are monkeys that have essentially a task. Now, when we do this in humans, it's usually due to a fracture, and the cast is on for a couple of weeks. And there actually is evidence that this happens in humans, but it's confounded by the injury, of course. But in otherwise normal monkeys, if you do this, you start to see these red areas, the digit areas, decrease in size. Now, these are very long periods of time, but even after 4 months of restriction, seeing this decrease in the size of the digit representations, you take the cast off, and within a few weeks, the maps recover back to normal. So this is a reversible process in an otherwise healthy animal. But we think that's a very important study because we know that after stroke, not only do you have the injury, but you have the disuse associated with the injury. And this experiment was really to try to dissociate those effects. So disuse alone will cause these kinds of changes in motor maps. Now, this is a study that that's very important to show you, at least at a local level, why you see changes in maps. And this is a mapping study done in macaque monkeys by one of my colleagues in Kansas, Paul Cheney, who really developed spike-triggered averaging, where you have an awake animal, you record individual action potentials from motor cortex neurons and which muscles they facilitate. In this case, it's actually a little simpler technique where the animal is behaving, performing a task, and you provide a single stimulus to the cortex and see which muscles are evoked. And you don't have to see the muscles, but this is a monkey that's been instrumented with about 24 EMG electrodes, and these are different sites on the cortex, and you see that at each site there are multiple muscles that are facilitated by a single pulse. You have to average many, many events before you see this. You typically don't see it with one pulse. These are very low-level pulses, but it gives you an indication of which muscles that group of neurons facilitates. And different sites will show you different muscles. So you have this mixture of multi-muscle representations, and what that looks like diagrammatically is that you have colonies of cortical efferent zones that overlap. So the neurons, corticospinal neurons that project to one muscle are distributed here in white, those to another muscle in black. So if there, and you see that some of these actually can, from the standpoint of the muscle, the representation of that muscle is not in a strict labeled line column, but rather distributed throughout different areas where there are other muscles represented. So that if there is a focal injury in one area, it doesn't simply affect a single muscle, and in fact, there are still corticospinal neurons that can project to that muscle, and while a large number of neurons that originally controlled that muscle are now gone permanently with an ischemic injury, there are still corticospinal neurons that that are in other adjacent territories that can control that muscle, and so some, at least locally, you can have a control of function based on this distribution, mixed distribution of colonies of cortical efferents. We also know quite a bit about the fact that corticospinal neurons after this injury diverge and project to slightly different motor neuron pools, so the anatomy of these connections can also change. So part, at least locally, part of the rewiring that occurs after cortical ischemia doesn't have to have major sprouting, that there are pre-existing connections and, if you will, redundant connections from adjacent areas. And we showed very early on, and this is actually a video from NHK in Japan, who did a special on rehabilitation after stroke in monkeys, in which we let's see if we can get this to start. There we go. And this is actually in Japanese, so I'll mute it if the sound comes on. But this yellow is the hand or a representation of a squirrel monkey, in which we actually created the smallest ischemic infarct we could in the motor cortex hand area in yellow, and that resulted in impaired movement. in order to get the monkey to use the limb at all, as you might expect as in humans, we actually had to put a cast on the limb initially, on the good limb, that initially is very slow. Within a couple of weeks, learns to use that impaired hand more efficiently. This is a very small, minor stroke. But when you look at the cortex, the animals that had that rehabilitative therapy showed expansions of the hand area out into the adjacent blue elbow and shoulder territory. So because of these mixed colonies of neurons, at least on a local level, we can have changes in compensation, recovery in the function without major reorganization of the cortex. Now, one of the interesting things is that back in the early, in the mid-90s when we were doing this study, I learned about a gentleman, Ed Taub. I knew Ed, but I did not realize that he was pioneering something called forced use or constrained use movement therapy. There were so many parallels between the type of approach we used in our monkeys and the type of approach he was using in human patients with these activities of daily living. It's one of those rare events that in science where some basic science and clinical research occur at approximately the same time and become symbiotic. We were able to show a clinical application for what we were doing. Taub and his colleagues were able to show that there was a potential neural basis for these effects. What we then showed is that there are changes throughout the brain. Dr. Klein showed that the compensation occurs because the rest of the brain can compensate. And these are just two of the many motor areas that exist in non-human primates. And this is the primary motor cortex. This is one of the premotor areas in a primate. So if there's a larger lesion and you don't have the adjoining colonies to accommodate the control of motor control of those muscles, this diagram shows the focal injury in the main motor area, a peri-infarct zone. And because of intracortical connections and these overlapping colonies, the local cortex has the ability to reorganize. But also, these remote motor areas are also able to reorganize. And they are connected with the injured zone and can adapt as a result. And we show that these premotor areas actually increase in their territory directly as a result of the motor cortex injury. They're linear related to the amount of damage to motor cortex. And we have some recent data showing with so-called forced use, animals with slings, casts on their good limb for several weeks to months at a time, that these premotor areas more than double in size occasionally with this long-term forced use. Now, of course, this is not a standard protocol for humans, but these animals have these constraint devices on 24 hours a day, but clearly the mass can expand. Again, the map is a biomarker. It doesn't really tell us directly what's happening with functional recovery. We also know that there are anatomical changes that occur in the monkey brain, that the premotor cortex begins to make direct anatomical connections with the somatosensory cortex, and that connection does not exist in normal monkeys. We have direct connections between primary motor cortex and somatosensory cortex, but not with the premotor areas. So why that might occur can be explained by this diagram. After an injury to the primary motor cortex, we not only eliminate the motor outputs, and this is a point I try to make in a very salient way that motor cortex injury and the results of motor cortex injury are not simply due to the loss of corticospinal outputs. The primary motor cortex is an important node of integration of somatosensory inputs and motor outputs. So if you look at this diagram, the primary motor cortex has intimate connections with the somatosensory cortex. And we know that in our monkeys, if we make a lesion in part of the motor cortex, the animals have ballistic movements. They overreach their targets. Even if they can still move, they do not have the proprioceptive input combined with the motor outputs. If it's in the cutaneous zone of motor cortex, they have asteriognosia, where they look in their hands to see if they picked up a pellet or not. Somatosensory motor integration is lost, just as much as the motor outputs are lost. These premotor areas don't have direct connections to somatosensory cortex, and so after initial diastasis, recovery begins to occur, but it's also associated with new de novo connections forming between premotor cortex and somatosensory cortex, as if it's trying to reestablish this somatosensory motor reintegration in a new area. So this is one of the features that we've been exploring quite a bit, and I will go into that in a direct way to try to manipulate that in a few moments here. I will say that these maps are not a true biomarker of recovery in the sense that when we look at the time course of recovery and the time course of map changes, they don't always match. And here's an example of a monkey with a very large lesion in the motor cortex, middle subarachnoid territory. The only motor area that was actually left intact in this animal was the somatosensory motor map here on the midline. And these animals, if you look at their behavior, their motor deficits are severe. They have recovery over the first 3 weeks, and then they plateau. They don't seem to get better in their motor performance. If you look at their motor maps in the remaining somatosensory motor area during that time, it's actually smaller initially than it was during the baseline period. It's only after many, many weeks that you see the expansion in the somatosensory map. So if map expansion is somehow a biomarker of recovery, how could it be that it's smallest at this point when the behavior has already plateaued? So there's something happening in that intervening period, and these maps undergo much slower changes. And I think that's telling us something very important about changes that take place over time that may be set into motion by the injury, may be set into motion by a rehabilitation intervention that are only expressed physiologically much later. So there may be more recovery potential than what we see in these simple performance maps. We tried to get at that in a rat, and by the way, rats have similar motor areas to primates. They just have their motor cortex is a little less specialized. So instead of multiple premotor areas, as you see here in yellow, the rat has one that we would contend is a premotor area, usually referred to as rostral foramen area. And by using these pellet retrieval paths and ischemic infarcts using the endothelin 1 model that you already saw, we looked at the recovery profile of animals that had rehabilitative training, repeated practice with pellet retrieval during post-injury days 7 through 17. So you have this 10-day window starting 1 week after the injury. The animals have similar deficits. The animals that have the practice with the pellets do much better than those that don't. And then they plateau. Now, there probably is a ceiling effect here, but these animals with the that are undergoing the rehab seem to have plateaued, and they don't do much better. The animals with no rehab never actually get up to the level of the rehabilitated animals. So what happens to motor maps at those time points? So we'll look at a couple of different time points, much like you saw in the monkey. With no rehab, there really aren't many changes in these maps. And this is actually a primary motor cortex, so over here for the rat, primary motor cortex lesion, and looking at the changes in the rostral foramen area. And you see very little change without any rehab. With rehabilitation, in fact, at day 18, immediately after the training, the map is at its smallest point, just like we saw before. Day 38, we see now a month later that the premotor map is greatly expanded, much like we saw in the monkey. So why would this be? The behavioral performance has not changed, but the map has changed. So one of the things, there are many hypotheses why you would have this mismatch between map physiology and behavior. But one is that, well, we have a ceiling effect in the performance, but maybe the quality of the movement is changing during that time. Maybe the kinematics of the rat's foramen movements might tell us something about changes that the performance just doesn't tell us. And so we've looked at a number of different characteristics. This is actually based on a qualitative scale of normal kinematics that Ian Wishaw developed. And just like humans, monkeys and rats have more of an issue with release than they do with grasp after these kinds of injuries. So if we look at normal release here prior to the lesion, they get worse. The animals with rehabilitation actually start to get better during their training period. And they actually, by the time, and even after the training, they're getting better and better. And by the time we get out here a month later, they're virtually normal in their release patterns. Whereas the animals with no rehabilitation, well, they get a little bit better. They have not achieved the normal kinematics. So we think a lot of the changes in these maps is due to subtle changes in the kinematics. The quality of the movement is changing, even after we see performance plateau, that there are still behavioral changes that are occurring. So I think that this is something we really need to be aware of in our human subjects, that the physiology of maps, either with fMRI or TMS or other methods, may be telling us something that is disconnected in time from the behavioral recovery. And we think it may be a very important thing. So I'd like to the rest of the time, tell you a little bit about modulating motor function with various types of stimulation techniques. We know about repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation, transcranial direct current stimulation that is becoming more popular because it's very cheap and easy to do, easy to provide sham controls. And even in 23, if we lived to 2350, you might see even a fancier approach that we saw in Star Trek a few years ago, when Picard had brain damage and had a cortical stimulator upon. Most of these techniques tend to work best in combination with some type of behavioral experience. In the case of PDCS and TMS, typically the stimulation is applied, and because it has a lasting effect for at least 30 minutes, then the rehabilitation occurs. We know that, for example, rTMS is a biomarker of plasticity. It increases the motor evoked potentials in this recent review by Wolf Zeman. But if you look at the meta-analysis of these kinds of approaches, we rarely see large benefits of the combination, either rTMS alone or the combination with behavioral function. But notice the, except in some rare instances, the numbers of patients in these studies is usually extremely small. So while we have these meta-analyses, what they mean with such small numbers of patients in trials that have various types of rehabilitation interventions, various types of protocols for stimulation, it's very difficult to interpret this at the moment. But there has yet to be a really dramatic effect in a large randomized clinical trial with these types of approaches. One of the more direct approaches was done with epidural stimulation, requiring a neurosurgical procedure. Jeff Klein, Teresa Jones, and I were involved in some of the early animal work using this technique, and it was very promising. This was a fairly large trial with 94 patients actually implanted with epidural electrodes, and this was combined with rehabilitative treatment. And the results were negative. Both groups actually improved, both the rehabilitation only and the rehabilitation plus cortical stimulation group improved, but this was the primary outcome. And so when this occurred, the company that developed this, basically their stock fell and they eventually went out of business. The follow-up data, now this is secondary data analysis, but it's worth noting that when you look at the 24-week follow-up, the rehabilitation-only group that was the control group fell off fairly dramatically, while there was maintenance of function in the investigational arm. Now, you have to see this with a grain of salt, because this was a neurosurgical procedure that was not conducted in this control arm that had rehabilitation, and you can imagine the placebo effects potentially occurring with having a neurosurgical procedure. But, again, it indicates that there may be very long-term consequences of these interventions that are not observed until very late after the trial and after the primary outcome has been shown. We've repeated this in non-human primates in a very similar protocol to the Everest data with epidural stimulation. We also found no effect at the four-week outcome with cortical stimulation. So the jury is still out, but we did not have, again, the long-term follow-up data. And finally, I want to, the dog sled team is about to depart, but I think I still have a few minutes to describe this last bit of neuromodulation that the field is changing very fast. The neurotechnology field is changing very fast. There are some unique approaches, and one of them is to use closed-loop stimulation. That is, instead of just stimulating randomly or at a steady rate or a theta burst rhythm, that you use some kind of physiological feature as a basis to decide when to stimulate. And so one of the more common approaches that's been used recently that you may have heard about is this NeuroPace device for epilepsy, in which the surface electrodes will detect in the EEG epileptiform discharges, and then a site that is thought to be amenable to stimulation will, in a sense, turn off the seizure before it occurs. And certain types of seizures, there is a lower incidence of seizures in patients. And so this is now an approved, FDA-approved device, that is an example of a closed-loop stimulation procedure based on the EEG activity. There is quite a bit of interest right now in deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's disease. It's thought that the beta rhythms that can be recorded in the basal ganglia are somehow related to the pathology. And so these investigators, in this very small group of 8 patients, although there are a number of other studies ongoing like this, use the beta rhythm to decide when to stimulate with deep brain stimulation, and either with continuous deep brain stimulation as it's typically applied, there's, as they call it, adaptive deep brain stimulation or random stimulation, they actually got a little bit better results on the Parkinson's, Unified Parkinson's Disease Rating Scale with adaptive DBS. There's quite a bit of interest in the DBS field that this may be the next new wave of deep brain stimulation to use some kind of closed-loop feedback control. But we are particularly interested in the type of plasticity that's induced by the proper timing of events. And this was something that was based on Donald Hebb's work back in the 40s that suggested when one cell fires prior to another cell, that the synaptic response is potentiated in that second cell. And in fact, this study by Jackson et al., F. Betts and his colleagues showed that there's a fairly narrow time window up through about 50 to 75 milliseconds between a reported spike and a stimulation applied to the cortex that you could change the outputs of neurons by this so-called spike timing dependent plasticity. So, and this is, of course, now the modern maxim, cells that fire together wire together. Maybe we can change plasticity at the synaptic level with spike timing dependent plasticity. Now, I told you about somatosensory motor interactions. So we had the rationale that if with a motor cortex injury, perhaps we can use spike timing dependent plasticity to reinforce that particular pathway between somatosensory cortex and the remaining premotor cortex to enhance that connectivity. We did so in a rat model, once again reminding you the rat premotor cortex, the rat primary motor cortex, and with the sounds that you hear are action potentials recorded from electrodes in a wireless device that we developed, and positive. So those are spikes from the premotor cortex. If you notice, my graduate student who helped develop this and was one of the co-inventors on this device missed the forelimb area the first time, and so this electrode, if any of you were really paying attention, we missed. It was in the neck. So these are neck motor neurons. So watch when the rat lifts his head. So, but it's very specific. So if we move that over into the forelimb area, it only responds when the forelimb moves. These are individual action potentials that were discriminated in real time by this device. My colleagues at Case Western Reserve University developed this small microchip, and this is the entire device that's wireless and battery operated and can be implanted on the rat's head. He's freely moving. And now we can do a study where we make, and this actually was funded by the Department of Defense, the U.S. Army, because it's so interested in soldiers coming back with traumatic brain injuries. This was a controlled cortical impact injury in the motor cortex of the rat. The rat also has a somatosensory cortex. It has this premotor cortex. So we use this closed-loop device using Hebb's approach. Every time spikes occurred in the premotor cortex, stimulate the somatosensory cortex. And for this study, no rehabilitation. The only rehabilitation is the conditioning of that pathway. And this device is on 24 hours a day. Even when the animal's sleeping, spikes occur in the premotor cortex. It stimulates the somatosensory cortex to reinforce that connection. And so the delays between detecting a spike and stimulating was about 7.5 milliseconds, very short. So this device had to precisely time those events. It's on 24 hours a day, and compared to no stimulation or random stimulation. And so this is the idea that we wanted to see if we could change the activity. And somehow I've lost my videos. Oh, here we go. We just got reversed. Okay, so you've seen this before from Jeff. This is a normal rat retrieving pellets, and for this particular task, they get up to about 80%. I think our rats are a little smaller. And this is a control rat. He has a controlled cortical impact in the motor cortex, no device in this case, and you will see the trajectory errors that while he can still move the limb, we believe a lot of these deficits are due to this somatosensory motor impairment, so the proprioceptive inputs are not integrated with the motor outputs normally. Because the premotor cortex still has corticospinal projections. Purportedly, it can still control movement. And here's an animal, has had the device on for 8 days. He's not perfect, but you will see that you can see the device there with the antenna sticking out. And much less impaired than the control animal. In order to really test this and how quickly the device can actually affect the movement, we brought an animal into the lab after 8 days of the therapy, suddenly turned the device off. So he's had it on for 8 days, 24 hours a day. Let's turn it off and see what happens, then turn it back on. We actually had to tether the animal for this. We didn't have this wirelessly programmed to do this, so you'll see this animal is tethered. But here is the animal. First, you'll see with the device off, and so you see he has these trajectory errors, and he's not able to retrieve the device. Every now and then he'll be able to get a pellet, but very rarely. He's trying. It's not for lack of trying, and you really want to root for the rat at this point. So here in a moment. 3 minutes time to reprogram the device. It's now on, linking your premotor cortex to the somatosensory cortex, and we'll see this rat's behavior. And you see that same rat, same day, he now is much better at this task, and not perfect yet, but certainly better with this conditioning of this pathway between somatosensory and motor cortex. And if you look at the behavior of the groups, the animals with activity-dependent stimulation or this closed-loop approach, they really come back to normal levels. Even random stimulation in somatosensory cortex helps, but not as much as this closed-loop stimulation. I just show you this briefly to show you that the open-loop stimulation, just random stimulation, has no effect on spike activity. But a test stimulus in the somatosensory cortex to see if you can evoke spikes. How good is this connection now? Do we have communication between somatosensory cortex and motor cortex? With the open loop or random stimulation, there doesn't seem to be any effect. When activity-dependent stimulation is off, of course, there's no evoked spikes. Here, suddenly, with several days of stimulation, we get very short latency spikes. These are the numbers of spikes within the first 20 milliseconds after this test pulse, showing us that the synaptic activity has been enhanced. And it actually increases over time in conjunction with the behavioral response. We're now following up these experiments with another Department of Defense grant to try to optimize these treatments to see if the time of intervention has an effect and whether you can turn the device off. It would be very important to know that you can explant one of these devices in a human afterwards. We're also developing a primate device and we'll be testing this in primates in the coming year. We've also extended this to spinal cord injury. Of course, after spinal cord contusion injuries, many patients are so-called neurologically complete, but not many are anatomically complete. So we're testing this in a rat model to see if we can reinforce synaptic potentiation of those remaining fibers that survived the injury. Now, this is my last slide. I just want to say that these neurotechnology devices are really coming on board very quickly. Some of them are non-invasive, require relatively a few regulatory hurdles are not very high. With these implanted devices, which we think ultimately would be most effective in pathway-specific neuromodulation, the costs are very high, and the timeline of development is very high, so it's very difficult to make this a commercially viable venture. So most of us in this field, as we are trying to repurpose existing approved devices for this. I heard a talk about from one of the inventors of one of the retinal implant devices that has been most successful recently, and his very first device was not a retinal implant in a patient with retinal degeneration or macular degeneration, but they used a cochlear implant device literally to stimulate the retina. So it's much easier to try to take an approved device, apply it to a new condition, especially with these invasive devices. The challenge is we don't have anything that will do this Hebbian-like approach of spike-triggered closed-loop conditioning over a lifetime. So this is still a very challenging field that I think we'll be hearing a lot more about these implanted neurotechnologies in the years to come. So I just want to end here to summarize. We know that spare brain structures are logical mechanistic basis for recovery function. I like to say that the injured brain is not a normal brain with a hole in it, but it's a completely rewired system. That rehabilitative training is correlated with structural and functional changes in network connectivity, but they're time dependent. But the relationship between these so-called physiological biomarkers and behavioral recovery is still not completely understood. But non-invasive and invasive neuromodulation approaches show promise, but this translation to human stroke and other types of brain injuries is still challenging, but I think you'll see quite a bit of interest in this field in the coming years. So thank you very much. The conditioning actually takes several days, and that was really at an intermediate time point in this learning process. They were just beginning to reach a threshold in their behavioral performance where they were significantly different than the other groups. So it was still being conditioned. At that time point, if you turn off the device, it immediately falls apart. As days go on, as you get up to 3 and 4 weeks, the effects last much longer. And so whether it's permanent, we don't know yet. That's actually the basis for our current study. But if it's a permanent effect, wonderful, we can leave a device implanted. We actually have technology that can do this for a short period of time, explant the device and treat it and go on with your life. If it has to be in for a lifetime, that's a much bigger challenge. Nonetheless, it may, even if that were the case, if we can target specific pathways that are damaged by a stroke, especially these parietal frontal networks, and there are many of them, in speech, and the arcuate vesiculus perhaps could be a target for this kind of conditioning. But it's just going to be a much larger challenge if the device has to be kept in over Wi-Fi. But with the implantable devices, they can be completely self-contained, and just like deep brain stimulation can be battery-operated using a subclavicular pack, and then the entire recording and stimulation system could be self-contained.
I can try to speak loudly. Thank you very much for wonderful talk. She's really give us lot of pioneer information about neural connectivity and some interesting potential we can really improve the rehabilitation. I actually back to your talk in the beginning about this Kotko map experiment there. I'm sort of thinking because there is certain of delay of Kotko map compared to the behavior, does that mean those training we have to continue in order to make some kind of structure changes? That means we might need to continue to train patients for a longer period in order to get to the real neuroplasticity like this.
That's certainly possible. And I think Dr. Jones will actually be talking a bit about some of these phenomena of duration of training. I think that the point that I wanted to make is that even if a rehabilitation therapy period is brief, a few weeks, the effects are seen in the nervous system not just immediately, but it may trigger a number of changes in gene expression that maybe are realized in the anatomy and physiology much later. Some of my colleagues here have shown that synaptic changes, for example, can require weeks to mature. And so that the anatomical and physiological changes that you see as a result of some manipulation, whether it's electrical stimulation or rehabilitative therapy, are not evident at the molecular or cellular level immediately. Some of them are, but many of them may take time to mature to really be fully analyzed, if you will, into the system. So there are very slow changes, and many people have shown, for example, after a cortical injury, there are inflammatory events that occur throughout the nervous system, including the spinal cord, that persist for many, many months. And so I think we have, even though stroke has this acute onset and then we think about the slow recovery, there are many molecular events that impact the behavior that occur over a much longer period of time. Certainly for months, perhaps a few years after the event. And so I think it's very important that we look at long, even though it's very expensive to do these studies in humans with follow-ups, that long-term follow-ups are very important. And I think we'll hear some more from Dr. Dromberg about long-term follow-up in various types of rehab trials. I don't think that the immediate post-intervention behavior or physiology it really tells us the complete story of what impact the therapy may have on the system.
Thank you for the explanation. I think it might be interesting for us as a clinician to know, because we can give patients 2 weeks of training, and we know this effect on the molecular level will last for several months. Or we have to give the patient several months of training in order to get there. So I think it could be very interesting for us to know about this important detail.
Yeah, I think it's a very important topic. And I think there are some challenges in the field that really are going to directly impact the way we give therapy. and we're touching on them here. One is how early, what is too early, what is too much, and now you introduced another, how long, and how long does the therapy have to extend? I think these are very critical questions. We try to address these in our animal models as best we can because we can control certain variables that we can't in humans. The human studies are very expensive to do over long, long time periods. Compliance becomes an issue with long therapy periods. But you raise a very important question.
Thank you very much. How can we increase or enlarge or specify the online proprioceptive information to the patients while they are performing movements in order to make them more qualitative?
Yeah, I think there are a number of people that are doing that, and you can imagine in the extreme case, if the proprioceptive information is a very salient. Features are coming into the nervous system, into the somatosensory cortex, but they're never integrated with that motor information and building those motor programs for proper output and online adjustment of movements that it won't be useful. However, of course, that extreme case doesn't exist. But there are always connections. We just have to make them decide, figure out how to make them much more efficient. And if we can't use these kinds of science fiction level techniques to integrate those areas, are there other ways that we can behaviorally integrate them in a more efficient way than stroke patients have available to them during natural recovery? And I think we just have to be clever about those types of interventions. But there are a number of groups that are actually trying to tackle that as well.